Okay, as I said, we've been going through the book of Daniel, and if you haven't been here the last few weeks, this might be a little bit confusing. You're kind of walking in halfway through the movie and asking, well, who's that, and who's this, and why did he do that, and we'll do our best. All right, Daniel chapter 8, verse 1. In the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, I, Daniel, had a vision after the one that had already appeared to me. In my vision, I saw myself in the citadel of Susa in the province of Elam. In the vision, I was beside the Ulai Canal. So this is 225 miles east of Babylon. Some kind of a vision, so he sees himself there. I looked up, and there before me was a ram with two horns standing beside the canal, and the horns were long. One of the horns was longer than the other, but grew up later. I watched the ram as it charged toward the west and the north and the south. So it probably looked like that. No animal could stand against it, and none could rescue it from its power. It did as it pleased and became great. Suddenly, a goat with a prominent horn between its eyes came from the west, crossing the whole earth without touching the ground. It came toward the two-horned ram I had seen standing beside the canal and charged at it in a great rage. I saw it attack the ram furiously, striking the ram and shattering its two horns. I said, striking the ram and shattering its two horns. The ram was powerless to stand against it. The goat knocked it to the ground and trampled on it, and none could rescue the ram from its power. Was that good? All right. Took like 15 minutes to do all that. It's no big deal. The goat became very great, but at the height of its power, the large horn was broken off, and in its place, four prominent horns grew up toward the four winds of heaven. So apparently this goat becomes bigger. Out of one of them came another horn, a smaller one, which started small but grew in power to the south and to the east and toward the beautiful land. That would be Israel. It grew until it reached the host of heavens, and it threw some of the starry host down to the earth and trampled on them. It set itself up to be as great as the commander of the army of the Lord. It took away the daily sacrifice from the Lord, and his sanctuary was thrown down. Because of rebellion, the Lord's people and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. Then I heard a holy one speaking, how long will it take for the vision to be fulfilled? He said to me, it will take 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary will be re-consecrated. What? You're coming out here tonight, a friend brought you and you're like, you said this was going to be cool. Why did we just watch that? I could have taken LSD and stayed at home and had a better vision. Well, what we've read up until this point really fits a lot with what extra-biblical prophecy is typically like. If you're a student of comparative religion, when you study so-called prophecies and other worldviews and psychics and those sort of things, this is typically what you get. You get these really confusing apocalyptic pictures. Doesn't make much sense. It's kind of like it fits anything and everything. Not so with biblical prophecy. With biblical prophecy, yeah, we do get these bizarre, I'll admit, fantastic visions. And yet, to find out the meaning, we just have to keep reading. So let's do that. Verse 15, while I, Daniel, was watching the vision and trying to understand it, there stood before me one who looked like a man. And I heard a man's voice from the Ulai calling, Gabriel, tell this man the meaning of the vision. So let's go back and actually look at this. What is the ram? Well, as far as explanation, we jump down to verse 20 where it says, the ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. Not that hard, right? The ram is this. It explicitly tells us. One of the horns was longer than the other. What is that supposed to mean? Well, this would fit with the Persian Empire. Remember the Media Persians. The Persians were more powerful than the Medes. And so this could account for that language, which would also fit with Daniel chapter 7, verse 5, wherein we saw as these prophecies correlate with one another into kind of a lock, a matrix that fits together, Daniel 2, 7, and 8, this second beast also is lifted up on one side. Persia, that would be a lock. I watched the ram as it charged toward the west, north, and south. Of course, this would perfectly fit with the Media-Persian Empire under King Cyrus. He was just raging through the ancient world, wiping everybody out. But what about the goat? What was that goat with the unihorn? Well, the shaggy goat, according to verse 21, represents the kingdom of Greece. Explicit. What's this mean? Greece. What's that mean? Media-Persia. The ram was powerless to stand against it. Well, that's true, historically speaking. The Grecian Empire took over the Media-Persian Empire, wiped it out in a period of a decade. Actually, in a period of 3 years. Came right through. The whole conquest of Alexander the Great took about a decade. They could not fight against it. And knocked the goat to the ground and trampled on it. The goat became very large. What's this part about the long horn breaking off the goat? Well, we read in verse 21, the large horn that is between the eyes is the first king. The first Grecian king to which this would refer is Alexander the Great. So he's the first king of this empire that has just come on the scene. What about this part? At the height of its power, the first king, it was broken off. Well, if you know history, you know that Alexander the Great started to fight around the age of 20. He was tutored by Aristotle. He was given the best training. He came right through the ancient world in a period of 10 years and just virtually wiped everyone out in his path. By the age of 32, there was no one else to conquer. I mean, he had basically just taken over the ancient world. And he was in a drunken stupor. Some people think that he fell into a fever, may have gotten sick. Other people think that he was poisoned by one of his generals, Cassander. Any way you look at it, Alexander the Great, at the peak of his power, fell over dead. What about this part? In its place, four prominent horns grew up toward the four winds of heaven. Again, we jump down to verse 22. What are the four horns? These are four kingdoms. Well, how would this fit with the Grecian Empire? So we had Alexander, and then after that horn, the first king, we got four horns. What's that about? Well, again, if you know your Grecian history, you know that after Alexander the Great died, he didn't have an heir to whom he could bequeath his kingdom. He had a son who was quickly killed. He had somebody else. They were put away. Well, it came to be that the four generals of Alexander started an infighting, really a power vacuum to take over. The first of whom was Cassander. The second was Lysicomus. The third was Ptolemy the First. And the fourth was Seleucus. Now these two empires, the Ptolemaic Empire and the Seleucid Empire, they were on either side of the nation of Israel, and they liked Israel as kind of like a buffer zone to keep them in between and to kind of have that neutral territory, kind of like Sweden or something, in between to keep them away from each other, and also for the fact that they were going to take taxes for Israel. And so over the course of the next several hundred years, really 150 years, these two empires waged war over Israel. What is this little horn? Another horn grew up small but grew in power. Well, again, verse 23 tells us that this little horn is a fierce king. The rest of them are kings. This one's a king. Little horn. We know this. We studied Daniel 7. This is probably the little horn of Daniel 7. That would be correlation, right? These two locking together. Wrong. Not true. Those two are similar. The little horn of Daniel 7, whom we called the Antichrist, or what Revelation calls the beast, what Paul calls the son of destruction. They're similar. They both persecute God's people. They're both incredibly wicked. They both oppose God. They both destroy the temple and so forth. But this horn in Daniel chapter 8, it's almost universally agreed that this is not the figure of Daniel 7. For one, this little horn, remember where it comes from. Does it come from Rome, as in chapter 7? No, it comes from Greece. Moreover, it comes out of four kingdoms, Cassander, Lysicomus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy, rather than 10 kingdoms, which is Daniel 7. We're later going to read, or I suppose we already read quickly, that this little horn reigns for 2,300 days. The little horn in Daniel 7 is different. He reigns for 3.5 years. So they're similar. They're close, but they're not the same. If they were the same, everything that's true of the first would be true of the second. But clearly these are not the case. Theologians and interpreters, as I said, are universally in agreement on the fact that Daniel chapter 8 is predicting Antiochus Epiphanes IV. He was a Seleucid king who came in and took over Israel from about 175 to 164 BC. What we would argue is that this figure is like a type. Theologians refer to types. Types are kind of like foreshadowings. I like to call them prototypes. Like imagine if you're an inventor and you create some kind of machine and you bring it into the venture capitalists and you show it to them and you click the button and it, you know, fries out. You say, well, it's just a prototype. Okay. It's not like the full fleet. It's not the final thing, but it's kind of like it. You know what I mean? Well, the same thing is true here. Remember that mountain illustration where the prophet is seeing one mountain and yet there's a huge gap of time behind that mountain into a fuller mountain behind it. So from the perspective of the viewer, the seer, it's hard to distinguish between the two. But as we come to discover throughout history, there's a huge gap of time. And in fact, this first figure, Antiochus Epiphanes IV, the small horn, is prototypical of this future Antichrist, the little horn. It says that this figure, Antiochus, reached the host of heavens and he trampled on them. Some people say, that Hebrew word, sabah. It's got to refer to angels, because typically angels are referred to as the host, the army of heaven. Well, verse 24 would disagree. Verse 24 says that he will destroy mighty men and holy people, not angels. In fact, this term, sabah, this can be used for angels, yes. It's also used for people. In fact, this same author in Daniel chapter 12, verse 3, refers to God's people as stars, like they're shining stars, is the way he describes them. That's the same language being used here. He's as great as the commander of the army of the Lord. He's making himself equal with God. This would fit Antiochus, this figure from the second century BC. Antiochus Epiphanes, what does Epiphanes mean? In Greek, it means God revealed, God manifest. Phaneru means to be revealed. So God manifest. Because of rebellion, the Lord's people and the daily sacrifice were given over to it, Antiochus. Well, this is true historically. The best historical works we have on this period come from 1 Maccabees and Josephus. Really, Josephus is a secondary source. He's using 1 and 2 Maccabees. But 1 Maccabees chapter 1 describes how Antiochus Epiphanes came into Israel, kicked down the doors, went right into the temple, killed the high priest, and over a period of 3 years, eventually put a sacrilegious pig into the temple. Now, many of us here are bacon eaters. We probably wouldn't care about that. Picture that you're a second century BC Jewish person. The swine was a filthy animal. You weren't even allowed to eat it. But Antiochus brings it into the temple and he sacrifices it, ripping it apart. Blood is going everywhere in the Holy of Holies in the temple. And then he erects a statue to Zeus in the Jewish temple. He gets rid of daily sacrifices and he desecrates the temple. What comes to be known as the transgression of horror or the abomination that causes desolation. We also read it prospered in everything it did and truth was thrown to the ground. This is also true of Antiochus. You look at Antiochus Epiphanes. If you want to do some reading on this, the primary sources are 1 Maccabees chapter 1. It's only 70 some verses. And 2 Maccabees chapters 5 through 7. This is like the 2nd century BC Braveheart. Okay? You ever seen that movie? There's an earlier movie, Red Dawn, with Patrick Swayze. Same thing. Okay? It's basically these evil people from the outside come in, try and take over. And these faithful Jewish men called the Maccabees, Judas Maccabeus and his father and his brothers fight and stand up with guerrilla warfare to kill Antiochus and to kick these Greeks out of their land. Why would they do that? Well, Antiochus Epiphanes was a real sicko, historically speaking. One of the things that he does in 2 Maccabees chapter 7 is he tortures a Jewish mother because she wouldn't eat pig meat. And so she brings up one of her seven sons up to the front. And he says, you need to eat it. He refused. So they ripped out his tongue, skinned him, cut off his legs, and then they put him onto a frying pan and cooked him in view of the mother and six brothers. Then they brought up the next brother. Same thing. Will you eat the pig meat? No. He was thrown on the skillet. And so forth, all the way down to the final one until they killed the mother and threw her on too. There are just lurid, savage stories of this period of history. One example was Antiochus heard that one of the Jewish women had circumcised one of her boys, infants, on the eighth day. So he came in and had the infants killed and then hung the infants over the mother's neck for a full week. She had to walk around the city that way until he just threw her off a cliff. He forbade circumcision. He forbade owning the scriptures. He forbade the Sabbaths. He forbade the daily sacrifice. This is definitely Antiochus, a real scumbag. Then I heard a holy one speaking. How long will it take for the vision to be fulfilled? And he said it'll be 2300 evenings and mornings. To what does this refer? There's two different options here, these 2300 evenings and mornings. One perspective is by Gleason Archer. He argues that when it says evenings and mornings, this lines up with the verse which came before, which is the daily sacrifices. Well, in Jewish culture, according to Exodus 29, you would have to sacrifice something at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day. So 2,300 sacrifices would be 1,150 days. This would put it not quite at 3.5 years. Remember, I was comparing the little horn with the small horn here. Not quite the same, but similar. And this would date somewhere from December 167, where Antiochus comes into the temple, performs the abomination of desolation, and then as a consequence, 3 years later, he's run out and he eventually dies. That's one option. Another option is that these are referring to full days. This is the view that I hold. Evenings and mornings, where have we heard that language before? Well, we've heard it in the book of Genesis. In the book of Genesis, evening and morning is one full day. 2,300 days would be equivalent to about 6.3 years. So what's the dating here? Well, this would go from the murder of the high priest, Onias III, in 170 BC, all the way down until 164 in December. Now, for those of us who come from a Jewish background, you know what happened in 164 BC, don't you? The Festival of Lights, Hanukkah. At the end of this horrible persecution, the Jewish people developed a holiday out of this, that they kicked out the evil Greek Empire, and God backed up what they were doing and gave them sovereignty over their nation. Well, he said, then the sanctuary will be reconsecrated. That's precisely what did happen. And so that brings us back to the book of Daniel. One thing we should look at here, we're saying that this has already been fulfilled in Antiochus Epiphanes, and yet we get some hints here, some cues for the interpreter. We read in verse 17, as he came near the place where I was standing, I was terrified and fell prostrate. Son of man, he said to me, understand that the vision concerns the time of the end. Well, that's strange. I thought this was already fulfilled. It was and it wasn't. It's like, did you create your invention? Well, I got a prototype, but it's not quite fulfilled. Again, in verse 19, I'm going to tell you what will happen later in the time of wrath. Because the vision concerns the appointed time of the end. And again in 26, the vision of the evenings and mornings that has been given you is true, but seal up the vision for it concerns the distant future. So there's some sense in which this Antiochus Epiphanes is a foreshadowing of this future Antichrist, whom we've already studied. Now let's think about this for a second. Let's put ourselves in the shoes of a 6th century BC Jewish person who knows Daniel. You're sitting there in about 550 BC when he gets this vision. Maybe he didn't read it until 519 when he publishes all this. Hey, I heard Daniel predicted that Israel is going to be regathered. You know, at this point in history, 550 BC, the Jewish people had just freshly been kicked out of their land. They'd been tortured, killed, run out by the Babylonians. They're in exile. And here you have Daniel saying, yeah, but I'm telling you, I got this vision. We will be back there. And then he predicted that there's going to be a rebuilt temple. Again, if you're around at that time, you'd be thinking to yourself, we just witnessed the temple get demolished. What do you mean there's going to be a rebuilt temple? Then he says that there's going to be like this statewide persecution. And again, I mean, maybe this would be the most believable part when you know the history of the Jewish people, constantly oppressed, constantly suffering. And yet this whole picture at the time, 6th century BC, would be very, very, very difficult to swallow, wouldn't it? You could imagine the ancient Jewish men sitting around the water cooler talking about this. You hear what Daniel predicted lately? Regathering. And he says it's going to happen soon. Yeah, there's going to be a statewide persecution, a rebuilt temple. That's kind of absurd. And yet, from our vantage point, there's nothing absurd about it. That's not prophecy, that's history. We've seen this all happen, precisely as he predicted. Then we flash forward to today. And we're studying these prophecies about the future as well, which Daniel has for us. In fact, he's explicitly told us that this is referring to the end. In these prophecies, throughout the Old and New Testament, we also get the same exact picture. That there's going to be a regathered Israel, like from all four corners of the globe. We get the picture that there's going to be a rebuilt temple in the city of Jerusalem, where it used to stand. There's also going to be this statewide persecution, although it's not going to be provincial like it was in Antiochus's day. It's going to be global. And you know, for us to look at that, that's kind of a difficult picture to swallow. And yet, it does point to the fact that we're interpreting this correctly, doesn't it? If the first part was fulfilled literally, this must mean that these other predictions, which are not yet fulfilled, will also be fulfilled in the same fashion. Let's start with that first one there, the regathering of Israel. Today? Well, yeah. When we turn on our news, where is all of the hotbedded anger and violence and war going on? It's going on right there in Israel. They're surrounded by nations who hate them. Warfare, it's just like what everyone's covering. We're used to this. We were born into it. Well, this was predicted long, long ago, the book of Isaiah. This dates to about 2,700 years ago. And this is what it says in 11:11. It says, "The Lord will again recover the second time with his hand the remnant of his people." Now notice what's that saying. Some theologians take this and they say, well, the first gathering was in the Exodus. That's where God brought all the people together. And the second gathering was during the exile, during Daniel's day. That's the second time. No, because look at what it says. The remnant of his people. The remnant of it. The Exodus was not a remnant. It was all the people. It wasn't a small portion of them. When it says that he will recover the second time, that's second to Isaiah's day. That there's going to be a first regathering under Ezra and Nehemiah, and then that there's going to be a future regathering. Notice too what it says. From all these nations, these are modern day Iran, Iraq, all over the ancient world. But then it goes on to say, from the islands of the sea, from the four corners of the earth. That wouldn't fit with the regathering under Daniel's day, would it? No, they were scattered in one direction, Persia or Babylon. That was it. This is saying it's going to be coming omnidirectionally from all these different areas of the globe, and they're going to be flooding back into Israel a second time. Well, it goes without saying that there are dozens of these predictions. And I don't think I'm exaggerating there. I brought a list here. Moses mentions it. Isaiah mentions it. Jeremiah mentions it. Ezekiel, Hosea, Micah, Zephaniah, Zechariah, Paul, Jesus, John mentioned this regathering of Israel. I mean, if we were to read through these, we would be here all night long. This was predicted way in 2 millennia in advance, at least. Second, this is a historically unique event. Just think about this for a second. Okay, the Jewish people were in their land in the first century AD. The Romans come in, they desecrate the temple, they kick all of them out. Over the course of about 80 years, the Jewish people were banned from being on the land of Israel. They then spread out globally to the four corners of the earth, Europe, the United States, Africa, Australia. They're all over the place. Then after 20 centuries, they are regathered in 1948 in the state of Israel. Since that time, about 5 to 6 million Jewish people have come into the nation. Think about how strange that is. Imagine if there was a prophecy that said something like this. The Native American people will be conquered by Europeans, and then after 400 years, they will kick the Europeans out of their land and take over North America again. And imagine if we had several dozen prophecies that spoke exactly like that. Let me tell you, that prophecy I just gave, far more likely to happen than this one. Yeah, the Native Americans kicking all of us out and taking over the land, far more likely. That's because they've only been displaced for 400 years. We're talking about a period of time here that is five times longer, where they were spread out, they kept a social, ethnic, and religious identity. That's odd. They had no locus, no nation, no central hub, but they knew that they were Jews. They practiced kosher. They're all out, and yet they were regathered, and Native Americans are still in this land. The Jewish people were exported out of their land and came back. Very unique. So unique, even Christian theologians can't believe it. How about that? Here's Louis Burkhoff. He's a Reformed theologian. This is from his dogmatic treatise, Systematic Theology, 800-page book, probably put you to sleep. In the context here, on page 712, he's writing about the predictions about Israel's national regathering. And he takes it metaphorically. Okay, so he says, this literalism lands interpreters in all kinds of absurdities. For it involves the future restoration of all of the former historical conditions of Israel's life. The altered situation would make it necessary for all the nations to visit Jerusalem from year to year in order to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. You see what he's saying? If you take this literally, like these dozens of predictions, literal, that means that Israel would have to be reformed and then the nations are going to come in and visit. He just said, how did he put it? He said that would be absurd. It'd be absurd to believe that. Notice when he's writing. 1939. One decade later, the nation of Israel was regathered. 1948. I've looked at his more recent updated editions. He didn't take this part out. God knows why. How embarrassing would it have to be to say that's totally absurd, and 10 years later, there it is. Thirdly, this prophecy wasn't fulfilled by the Jewish people. This wasn't self-fulfilled. This was fulfilled by people who didn't believe in the Bible. One of the hallmarks of modern Israel today is the fact that they are so consistently non-religious. They're ethnically Jewish. Most of them are ethnically Jewish, but spiritually Jewish, like believing in their Bible, taking the Bible literally, taking it to mean that it has accurate predictive prophecy. Most do not fit into that category. About half of Israel today, the modern state of Israel, is non-religious or anti-religious, way higher than the United States. Only 12% identify themselves as religious, and 5% is Orthodox. So they are in the far minority. And as we start to study this history of Zionism, is what it's called. It was led by a man by the name of Theodore Herzl. He's kind of the Abraham Lincoln, the Ben Franklin of the day. He was the man who brought this together. He was secular. He was not a religious man. We also see that after the Holocaust, the most egregious tragedy the world had ever seen had just happened before the world's eyes. And it was publicized. I mean, you're getting pictures of these concentration camps. Well, the newly formed United Nations came together and said, we're going to give these people who have been massacred and brutalized and tortured a little chunk of land in Israel. One of the proponents of this was the atheistic nation, the USSR. So what are we saying here? We're saying, yeah, it was self-fulfilled by an atheistic communist bloc. How does that make any sense? You ever heard those conspiracy theories that the Holocaust never happened? You ever heard that? You know where it comes from? It comes from this. After the world looked on the Holocaust, they decided in pity to give the Jewish people a nation state where they could go and defend themselves, where they would no longer be terrorized and hunted down like animals, where they could be people with dignity and a nation. Well, conspiracy theorists say, well, the Holocaust was a big Jewish hoax. Really, why? Well, because that was the thing that got them their nation back. Well, if you want to go down that road, you're going alone. I'm not going there with you. I mean, the Holocaust is probably the most historically documented event in human history. We have video footage, for goodness sakes. But that's the extreme you would have to go to. Also, some people say, well, this is self-fulfilled. They just made this happen. Okay, if it's so easy to do that, How come we've never seen a singular other example of this happening? Nothing like this. It's so cavalier. They probably just did it themselves. Really? So why isn't it just as easy for other people to do it? Like the Moabites. Like the Philistines. You ever met a Moabite? Bumped into any Philistines lately? No, they're gone. They were taken over. They were exiled. They're gone. The Jewish people have survived and have even been globally dispersed and then brought back to their land under the most horrific oppression you could imagine for a single people. In AD 70, the Romans killed, according to Josephus, 1.1 million Jewish people. Some historians think he might be exaggerating. Not by much. This was a slaughter. Rome called in the legions of soldiers, wiped these people out. A few decades later, there was the Bar Kokhba revolt. Bar Kokhba was supposed to be like a messianic figure who's going to kick the Romans out. The whole plan backfired. Emperor Hadrian sent in 6 legions of Roman soldiers, killed another 500,000 Jewish people. You flash forward to AD 325. Constantine, the quote-unquote Christian emperor, made Judaism illegal. You could not be Jewish and be a member of the state. We flash forward further, 1562. Polish legislation dictated that Jews must dress differently, can't own servants, and can't hold public office. Sound familiar? I hope you're not one of these people who thinks that anti-Semitism and hatred of Jews goes back to 1939 in Germany. This goes back the whole way, as far as we can go. It wasn't just so-called Christians either. Here's Voltaire. He's an agnostic French philosopher. He spoke of the Jews as, quote, our masters and our enemies, whom we at once detest. We find in the Jews only an ignorant and barbarous people who have long united the most sordid avarice, greed. There you go. Greedy Jews is what he's calling them. With the most detestable superstition and the most invincible hatred for every people by whom they are tolerated and enriched. And then he concludes, still, we ought not to burn them. It's a real bleeding heart, Voltaire. 1648, the Russian Cossacks, brutal Russian warriors. You should read these reports. Pick up David Rausch's book, A Legacy of Hatred. He goes into vivid detail, skinning alive, disemboweling, killing babies, raping women. Savage. 1775, Pope Pius VI issued his edict to the Jews, commending forced baptism and child abduction, where so-called Christians could go into people's houses, steal their Jewish babies, and baptize them so they wouldn't go to hell. Not to mention the Nazi Holocaust. We had a dictator in the last century with his men going into people's homes in a systematic fashion, killing 6 million Jewish people. Oh, self-fulfilled. Self-fulfilled. It's just so easy to say, yeah. Self-fulfilled. They went under the most horrific, horrid persecution over the longest time. Let's get some criteria by which we could judge this. This is from Douglas Kruger's book, What is Atheism, pages 96 to 98, where he takes on this topic of predictive prophecy. He gives some criteria here, and I'm quoting. Number one, the prophecy must be clear, and it must contain sufficient detail to make its fulfillment by a wide variety of possible events unlikely. Yes, that's what we find when we look at other forms of prophecy. Like I said, Nostradamus. I remember when Hurricane Katrina happened. On the History Channel, they had this program where they said, Quatrain 8, line 64, I can't remember what it was. They said, this predicted Hurricane Katrina, and it said that a swampy city will be flooded. There you go. Oh, yeah. How did we not see this coming? Clear, sufficient detail, okay? Now, when we look at these passages, again, we've got dozens that correlate and point toward the same direction, that at the end of human history, Israel will be a nation again. What about number two? The event that can fulfill the prophecy must be unusual or unique. Yes, both. Very unusual, has never happened before, highly improbable. Number three, the prophecy must be known to have been made before the event that it's supposed to have been fulfilled. Yes, this is what they call in Latin an ex eventu prophecy. That's where you're actually writing about something in the past, claiming it's prophetic. Well, this isn't even debatable. These manuscripts which we have go back 2,000 years or more. Number four, the event foretold must not be of the sort that could be the result of an educated guess. Yes, how could you predict something like this? Then he says, number five, the event that fulfills the prophecy cannot be staged or the relevant circumstances manipulated by those aware of the prophecy in such a way as to intentionally cause the prophecy to be fulfilled. A self-fulfilled prophecy. Well, if you think that's the answer, then who self-fulfilled it? It wasn't the Jewish people. It wasn't the USSR. Well, you think the Jewish people self-fulfilled this? You think they caused the Holocaust to happen with the off chance that there would be a United Nations that would come together to give them their land back? That's what you think. You think an atheistic nation like the USSR was promoting Bible prophecy? Now, is that possible? I guess that's possible, but is it probable? Is that the best explanation for what we're seeing here? Far from it. So, again, when we look at this question, impossibility, it isn't impossible. In fact, it's happened. It has happened. Right now, as we speak, there is an organization which is referred to as the Temple Institute in Israel, which has collected tens of millions of dollars to prepare to rebuild their temple. They're breeding the red heifer from Numbers 19. They're putting together the altar. They're setting aside the materials, ready for the moment where they can rebuild this temple. So the first part has been fulfilled. The second part, well, way more likely than the first part, which brings us to the final part, that what we've been reading about here is fitting a sequence. Think of Ezekiel 37, that God would regather the nation of Israel. And then Ezekiel 38, that is when the battle of Armageddon and the end of human history would occur. We're seeing this line up in our present day. So impossible? Far from it. Well, this brings us to our conclusion. You know, I don't know if you're coming out here tonight because you're trying to check out what you believe and investigate, maybe see what the Bible has to say. Maybe a buddy, you know, dragged you here and you're kind of like, oh, I'll give it a shot or whatever. You know, as we reflect on all this, that's a lot of information to take in, but I'd like to just conclude with one passage from the book of Isaiah. Isaiah 46 verse 9 says that, remember the things I have done in the past, says the Lord, for I alone am God. I am God. There is none like me. Only I can tell you the future before it even happens. Everything I plan will come to pass, for I do whatever I wish. This is a part in the book of Isaiah from chapters 40 to 48 where it's a taunt against the idols that are held up against God. And he says, if you're real, like if you're real gods, you're not just a figment of somebody's imagination, why don't you predict the future? God says, I alone can do that. I'm the only one who knows the future. And he differentiates himself from other gods on that basis. Like, how do we know we're not just believing in something because it makes us feel good? How do we know this isn't just a giant ruse, that this is just some kind of configuration to confuse us, maybe control us? It's because of stuff like this. When we come to the Bible, we discover a book that is really the only holy book that can be disproven. If you're looking into your faith, the Bible is the place to start. Why? Because it's the quickest one to disprove. Other holy books don't put their neck out on the line like this. Only the Bible makes these statements, which could be disproven. Look at this last part. Everything I plan will come to pass. I do whatever I wish. That can be kind of a scary thought when you think about it, that there's a God and he isn't me. That must mean that whatever he wants is going to happen. Like he's in charge. He's sovereign, to use theological language. And yet what's interesting about this is that the Bible teaches that his plan is actually for our own good. Jesus said this famously. He said, come to me, all of you who are weary and carry heavy burdens, and I will give you rest. I don't know if you're here tonight and you can resonate with that there. You're kind of limping in here. You've had that sense, you know, doing it my way, running away from God has not been working. Well, the message of Jesus is that you can come to him, you can find mercy, you can be loved in a personal, deep way, and he's going to give you rest for your soul. And that's all we got for tonight. So why don't we open up the floor here for maybe anybody who wants to make a point or,
Yeah, that was really sweet. I think, something that is exciting about this too is that the same plan that God's rolling out in the Bible for us as Christians, he gives us a place to play a part in that plan. That we can actually have a role in this like worldwide thing that he's been planning. And I know like when I hear this stuff and read it, the kind of thing that you start thinking about is like, man, why would I ever like do something else with my life? Like, why would I, really sign on to a bunch of things which at best are going to be over in 100, 200 years when I can have a role in this kind of plan with this kind of God who predicts things like that?
Yeah.
And it just makes it seem absolutely crazy to decide to like invest all your energy in something else.
Yeah. The more I study this material, the more convinced I become. And then to think if that's really true, then what we're doing here with our lives is incommensurably valuable and right in the middle of God's plan. Okay.
I was curious, since you referenced the thing that he wrote in 1939 before the Jewish regathering, what materials does he have like after that that talks about the regathering?
I haven't read anything from him. His book has been published into 3, 4, 5, 10 editions. One commentator that was commenting on Berkhof, who comes from his same theological school, he thinks that this whole business about the regathering of Israel is spiritual, it's not literal. And to him, his name was Sam Storms, he's the theologian. To him, he says that the regathering of Israel is profound, and he says it might just fall into the providence of God that, you know, at the end of history, many Jewish people are going to come to faith, on his view, Romans 11. But beyond that, it relates to what he calls, quote, mysterious providence. When I read that, I slapped my hand against my forehead and said, there's nothing mysterious about this. As though, oh, we don't really know what he's doing. It's very clear he's bringing them together because he predicted that he would.
I was just kind of thinking about like the Six-Day War, which came after that. I was wondering if you could touch on that, because that, like, from my understanding, was like huge for Israel, kind of like sealing the land that they were given from like nations that were wanting to like take it back.
Yeah. The history lesson here is in 1948, the Jewish people were given sovereignty over their land. But at that time as well, the British and many other people in the United Nations were protecting them. Now, as soon as the foreign defenders left, the next day, Israel was invaded. And so it led to the Six-Day War in 1967, which was actually pretty brutal, but the net effect of it was that the real estate given to Israel was inflated fourfold. So they took as far as Jerusalem. They took over all this land, and so the modern socio-political debate over Israel is over the question of, does that land belong to them, or should they give it back? President Obama, last term, was arguing that they should go back to pre-1967. I don't know where Trump is. Don't really care. My point here isn't the political aspect of it. When we say that this is happening and it's fulfilling Bible prophecy, we're not saying that God is causing it. That's to confuse foreknowledge with foreordination. God isn't saying he caused it. He's not causing the Holocaust. That was an instrumental aspect of bringing the people together. So he knows what's going to happen, but that's different than saying that he's causing it. So I've heard a lot of people say, well, I don't want to get into this because I hate what's happening in Israel. I hate a lot of it too. And so I'm right there shoulder to shoulder with you. Yeah.
To go off that last point you just made about the difference between foreknowledge and like God causing things, how do you balance like, and I guess correct me if I'm wrong, but the Bible talks about God kind of being like in control, like he's sovereign over things, he's sovereign over human history. Like, how do you balance that, like that, like he's in control of things with like he doesn't cause them to happen?
Yeah, well, the way theologians harmonize this is to say that God has a directive will and he has a permissive will, both of which would fall under the umbrella of sovereignty, which just means that he owns everything in the universe and he's in control. So if something happens that, you know, God brings a blessing into your life, that's his directive will. That's something that he's doing. However, if something bad happens that's outside of his moral will and his good nature, this would fall under his permissive will. Now, the way that that fits underneath sovereignty, that he's still in control, is that it means that God signed off on it. That thing happened and it was wrong, and he permitted it to happen. He allowed it to happen. Now the next question becomes, well, why does God allow bad things to happen? Why would he permit certain things like that? And that's a whole nother discussion. But just underneath the rubric of sovereignty, that's one way of thinking through it. Directive and permissive. All right. Well, I guess we're out of time. Why don't we pray here together? We'll close up. Yeah, as we look at these predictions of the future, Lord, we know that there are some things that are predicted which seem pretty scary. And yet we have far more predictions about what it's going to be like to be with you in heaven, that you're going to right every wrong, you're going to wipe every tear from our eyes. Thanks that we have that predicted for us as well, where we can live in the security of where we're headed. And Lord, I pray for those of us here tonight who are still on the fence. They haven't quite made that decision. Maybe they've been thinking about the decision to receive Christ into their lives. I pray that even now as they sit here with us, that they would have that surrendering of the heart to open up and to experience the love and the rest and the peace that Jesus wants to offer them. I pray that they would just call out to you and cry out to you in their heart, God, that they want the forgiveness that you've offered. And we thank you for anybody who might have done that here with us tonight. In Jesus' name, amen.